Hi, my name is Robin Miller, and this is Michael Longleaf, and or Michael Thompson from Longleaf Technical Services, and we're here to talk to you today about financial management for nonprofits. We did a similar webinar about a month ago with Wendy and Rachel, and hopefully you all watched that one, and this is sort of the second to that. I'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. On page 2 of the slides, which hopefully you now have, we talk about the mission of Pro Bono Partnership of Atlanta. And the mission is to provide free legal services to community-based nonprofits that serve low-income or disadvantaged individuals. We match eligible organizations with volunteer lawyers from leading corporations and law firms in Atlanta who can assist nonprofits with their business matters. We hope you'll enjoy this interactive webinar. You can email or type in your questions that you have as we go along. We also want to thank Georgia Legal Services for providing us with the service of presenting this webcast to you. And lastly, I need to mention that we are not providing specific legal or accounting advice as part of this webcast, but giving you general information that will hopefully help you as you look at in more detail your financial methods and policies. On slide 3, we have the eligibility requirements for Pro Bono Partnership of Atlanta. To be a client, you have to be an existing 501c3 organization with a stream of income. You have to be located in the greater Atlanta area, which has a very wide berth. And you have to be unable to afford legal services and serve low-income or disadvantaged individuals. We do these monthly webinars each month, and you can find out about us more on our website at www.pbpatl.org, or you can call our office. And that information is on the last slide of the presentation.
I guess for the next 30 minutes or so, we're going to talk about different things that are involved with very general accounting basics. The first slide is kind of just a little cartoon to kind of explain to you, though, that accounting is a very serious matter, and it is something that you really have to concentrate on. It is not something that is you can just do on as a part-time part of your organization. You really have to focus on being actively involved on a regular basis to do that. It's like doing your bank reconciliations at the end of the month with your home and writing your checks. You have to go in to make sure that each month you've completed certain tasks related to accounting. The three basic things that we want to talk about at the beginning are the type of reports that ultimately are going to come out of any type of accounting system that you might have. The first is the balance sheet. The balance sheet basically are the items that are your assets, your liabilities, and then your fund balance or your net assets, or if you were a for-profit entity, it would be called, basically your retained earnings, what's left over. And so at the end of the period, one thing you need to really understand is with an accounting system, the balance sheet, your assets always equals your liabilities plus your retained earnings or your fund balance. And that is at the end of the accounting cycle or at the very, very beginning of the accounting cycle. But it will always balance. So your assets equals your liabilities plus your retained earnings or your fund balance. The next one we're going to talk about is your income statement. Your income statement is your revenue, or in your case, in the case of a private nonprofit, any type of receipts that they may have or donations they may have, and your less your expenses. And your expenses can be anything from your rent to payroll to employee reimbursements. And then after that, you have your increase or decrease in fund balance. So you're going to have profit or loss, which would be an increase or a decrease in fund balance. It's always good to have a little more than a little less. So if you have constantly negative or decreases in fund balance, ultimately you'll be in big trouble. The next thing we want to talk about is budgeting, what good budgets are going to look like and how you can be effective in doing those. And then the third item we're going to talk about is internal controls. Internal controls involve everything from accounting and financial policies that you may have, what are good internal controls, and what risk you need to try to reduce and the creation of those policies so that your internal controls are very well intact. The four elements of really kind of any good accounting system are the recording of financial transactions. In other words, basically a transaction occurs relative to an asset or a liability or cash or something that you may have. You're going to need to record it. The next thing you need to do is classify it. So basically you want to group all your cash transactions into one account. You want to classify all of your assets, all of your fixed assets into one account. You want to classify all your rent expenses into one account. The next thing you want to do is summarize it. And basically summarizing is the segregation of each one of those accounts so that you're actually able to put together a balance sheet, or you're able to put together an income statement or a statement of cash flows. And I didn't mention statement of cash flows, but we'll get into that a little bit later, because statement of cash flows may be the most important report that you may have. Finally, you would also then have reporting of the financial transactions. So you have to create these reports. You're going to then have to present them either to the IRS, it might be to people that are wanting to possibly invest in your organization and give donations. You're going to want to be accountable to them. There have been too many times, and what I do basically for a living is I testify in court on legal matters, I do fraud investigations, and there's been too many times where I've had to go in and perform an investigation on somebody, including a private nonprofit, where there was a breakdown as far as keeping up with the books, and now as a result, you wind up in a huge legal issue. As I said, the balance sheet has three basics. It has assets. Assets are items such as cash, your vehicles, computers that you may own. It can involve any type of thing. There's a lot of things that are you may not think of as being assets, but in fact are. And if you have any questions as to whether or not you would classify, you can write in and I'll see if I can answer it. Liabilities are stuff like accounts payable, notes that you may have, where you may have borrowed money, taxes that are due. Fund balance is basically the difference between your assets and your liabilities. The next item is in the income statement is your revenues. Revenues in this case are mostly going to be donations. Expenses are stuff like office supplies and rents. Let's talk a little bit about statement of cash flow, because they are very, very important. What a statement of cash flow does, the purpose is to show you how the changes in the balance sheet and the income statement affect cash over a period of time. It shows your liquidity, your ability to pay debt, whether or not you actually are in a position that you're going to be able to cover your future expenses, and how you've done as far as covering your past expenses and relative to the cash that you've received. It's broken down into three major elements. One is the changes in operating activities. Those are the things that are like the unrestricted cash that you receive from donors. You then have changes in your investing activities. If you sell an asset or you sell a piece of property that you own, that would be a change in your investing activities because you've made an investment and now something has happened in that investment. And then changes in financing activities. That could be anywhere from changes in note balances where you've gone out and made long-term debt, or if you have a permanently restricted donation. For instance, there's a lot of times you'll get an endowment where money is set aside and you're going to just receive the proceeds from that money that's been set aside over a period of time. That is more of a financing activity than it is an operating activity, because that balance is used for financing your operations. The next slide I gave you is a typical balance sheet. And what a balance sheet looks like, this is very, very basic for best private nonprofit balance sheet. It shows usually 2 years or two periods that you want to look at. A lot of times you do that for comparative purposes. How am I looking this year as compared to last year? It's broken down, as we see, into assets and liabilities and fund balance. It's always best to keep your temporary restricted cash separate from your permanently restricted cash, and that separated from your unrestricted cash, because your unrestricted cash, you're going to have the ability to use it immediately, and people are going to want to see that, and you are going to want to understand that for purposes of your budget. Your restricted cash, you're not going to be able to use it, and you just don't. And keeping it separate, temporary meaning it's going to become available within 1 year. Permanently restricted may be that it never becomes available, or that it's going to be unavailable for in excess of a year. You're going to want to keep those items separate. The next slide, slide 10, is the income statement example as well. I put in there again, you have to look at your unrestricted cash, your restricted cash, and permanent restricted cash, and your temporary restricted cash, and so that you'll have a true understanding of what's going on relative to any type of revenue that you may have or receipts that you may have. You need to know which ones are that as they're coming in, whether they're restricted, unrestricted, permanently restricted. The next thing I did put in here, just for purposes of this example, is also budgets. You're always going to want to look at how does your revenue and expenses compare to what you had anticipated to occur for that period of time. And you're going to see whether you're over budget, under budget, how things are going, and whether or not you're actually meeting your obligations. Today, in this economic time that we're kind of experiencing, there's a lot of people that are anticipating a lot of revenue to come in, and in fact, they're not coming in as quickly or with as much money as you would anticipate. So as a result, you're going to have to make future expense considerations, whether or not you really can afford to buy that piece of equipment this year, or whether you're going to have to wait another year for that particular item to come in. So accounting, again, is used as a management tool for you to be able to manage certain items and certain things. At the end, you also have your fund balances and your changes in fund balances at the beginning, or at the end of the year. The next report that I'm showing you is an example of a cash flow statement. And let me back up. I realize and I understand that what I am doing is I am feeding you with a fire hose right now. I can just imagine that you, as someone who's trying to just basically understand accounting principles, understand what I'm trying to do is give you the big picture right now of what the reports are going to look like. We ultimately have to get to these reports through meticulous detail of recording of your of all of your transactions in a program. I believe with Pro Bono Partnerships, you guys use QuickBooks.
Yes, and a lot of nonprofits do use QuickBooks, and I believe Wendy Stewart and Rachel Spears both talked about that in the first one, that seems to be a very useful tool for nonprofits. It's you can use the one for nonprofits or just basic QuickBooks, and it is very easy to input your information and record all those transactions. And one of the key things is that if you do it regularly, then you can easily do that analysis of the budget to date so that you can be on top of and know when you might be falling behind what you were anticipating.
QuickBooks truly simplifies, and this is not a commercial for them, but they really simplify the transaction for people that are not advanced in accounting. And so, you know, I would recommend getting it, going in and going through the tutorials that they have available. I would not recommend the Macintosh version. I would recommend the Windows version. Trust me, I've actually had experience with the Macintosh version and wanted to burn it. but it is a very useful tool, and it's something that you may want to consider using. And if not QuickBooks, some other very basic small business accounting software would be very, very helpful to you. We're through the commercial.
Well, one other thing to note is that in all these kinds of systems, they have these reports ready, and to you, it's with a few clicks of a button, it will create a cash flow statement for you. Once you input the information initially and then continue following up, it's very easy to generate the three different statements and balance sheet and income statement and cash flow statement that Michael's been talking about. So it's not like you have to start from scratch to create all these things. It will gather the information for you and put it together for you to a certain extent.
Right. And the thing I think you always have to realize is cash is king. Everything's going to be driven around ultimately cash, because ultimately that's what's going to drive all of your accounting transactions. So it's going to start with basically the development of your checkbook. And you're going to write checks, you're going to receive cash, and you're going to write checks. And as you do, basically QuickBooks or any type of accounting software is going to say, as you write a check, they're going to say, well, what is this check for? And it's going to force you to classify that transaction into a particular area, whether it be an asset or paying off of a liability, or I've received some cash. Well, why did I receive it for? It was a note. And so as a result, it's going to record it as a liability for you. You also have to kind of understand that in any accounting system in modern America today, it is a double entry accounting system. Basically means that you have assets that are, you have debits and you have credits. And for every debit, you will have a corresponding credit. So if you have cash, they're going to say, okay, we're going to add cash into your bank account, and they're going to the computer program will automatically debit the cash for you. Well, there's going to be a corresponding credit, and they're going to say, well, where did you get this cash from? And let's say it was from a note that you received. Well, they're going to, as soon as you say this is for a note that I received from XYZ Bank, they're going to ultimately come in and credit a note payable to the bank, and the computer system will do it for you. So when it comes time to print your balance sheet, or it comes time to print your income statement, the computer program is automatically going to do a lot of these things for you, and it won't be that difficult for you to do.
Can you touch on what happens with a donation? Because in that case, it's a little, you know, intuitively, it seems like it should be different.
Right.
But
donations are basically a private nonprofit's revenue. And so you go in and you actually, I'm going to make a deposit, and these are the donations that I've received for the day. It's going to first debit your cash, and then it's going to credit revenue. One of the things that is a little difficult, and actually it kind of takes a little thought process to do this, is revenue is not a debit transaction. People think of, I've received cash. Well, cash is a debit transaction, but revenue is in fact generally a credit transaction. And so your expenses tend to be debits. And it's really something that I think for purposes of this webinar, we really don't need to get into, because again, the accounting program is going to do it for you. But as the transaction would be, this is revenue that I've received, or if you're using a for-profit accounting software, if you're using a non-profit accounting software, it's going to be a donation, but ultimately it's going to be considered, in effect, a revenue that you're going to use to pay your expenses with. A statement of cash flows, I did give you an example as well on page 11. It is cash received from unrestricted donors. It's the changes in those items. It's the changes that happen throughout that year that you're really going to be looking at. It's your investment income. It's those items that you've paid to your suppliers. Those are the operating activities that you used for your normal operations day to day. Again, activities like investing activities would be a purchases of equipment. And again, the accounting software is going to do this for you. And so as long as you're keeping up with on a monthly basis, and on a regular basis, your bank statement and doing your bank reconciliations, and you're doing your keeping up with your check register, a lot of this work is going to be done for you. Additions to an endowment or an additions to long-term debt could also be a financing activity, and this is an example. If you look, I did make sure that the balance sheet, the income statement, and the cash flow statement in this example all correspond to each other. So each one of these are interactive with each other, and you can actually look and say, okay, where this cash flow from unrestricted donors, where did it come from? Well, if you go back to the income statement, you'll see that your public contributions unrestricted are $70,000. That would be an unrestricted cash received from unrestricted donors. So each one of these are very interactive, and you can take a look and you can see how each one of these, you can trace the transaction from either the balance sheet to the statement of cash flows or from the income statement to the statement of cash flows. They're all very interactive with each other. That is always going to be the case in any good accounting system that you have.
One thing to note is that for a lot of organizations where they get grant money from state or federal government, and they are getting it as a reimbursement. A cash flow statement is very important so that you know that you have the ability to pay your employees and all of your expenses until that reimbursement comes in. It's a wonderful tool to use to ensure that you have the cash you need on hand when you know you're not going to get paid until you get reimbursed after you've expended the money.
The next thing I just want to talk about is how transactions are recorded. There are two times that you can record them. The examples I've been giving in the past few minutes have really been a cash accounting system. Basically, that means when you make the payment or when you receive the cash, you record the transaction. There are times where, and for generally accepted accounting principles, cash is generally not accepted, a cash accounting system. What they want to see is an accrual accounting system, and that's basically you record a transaction at a time when you incur it, not when it's committed. When, for instance, if somebody comes in and they legally bind a contribution to you, not just a pledge and say, okay, I'm going to pay you, I'll pledge $250 to Qantas this year. You can't come in and then say, okay, that pledge is now a legally obligated commitment, so I'm going to record that as revenue. It has to be a legally enforceable, unconditional pledge. And when those happen, and you know you're going to receive it, you could then record that transaction as revenue at that particular point in time. Or expenses. An expense like when you, I'm going to go pay this on my credit card so I don't have to pay it for another 30 days. Well, that's good. That may be good cash flow management, but for purposes of an accrual accounting system, you would record that expense at the point that you incurred that expense, not at the point that you in fact paid that expense. And so as a result, you may choose to go with an accrual accounting system or with a cash accounting system. The IRS will accept either one. If you're a larger organization, you're required to have an audit, you're going to have to use an accrual accounting system. That's going to be required for the CPA to sign off as a good accounting system that you may have. But once you choose a methodology, particularly at the very beginning, you need to stick with it. You do not need to be swapping them back and say, okay, it's more advantageous this year for me to be in an accrual system, so I'll go to an accrual system because I have a lot more expenses I haven't paid and I want to keep my fund balance low. This year it'll be more advantageous for me to be in a cash system. I believe the IRS will only allow you to change once. And once you've changed that one time, you can no longer change again. And it is extraordinarily difficult to make those types of changes. So it's best, I would say, if I was as an advisor, I would say it's best to start out as a cash system unless you really have good accounting background and good accounting experience, and then convert to accrual as you get larger and you're going to be needing an audit. Because it's a lot easier to convert that way than to go from an accrual system to a cash system. Enough being said about that. There are a lot of other components of accounting systems as well that you need to be aware of. A chart of accounts. Basically, the chart of accounts are all the accounts that you may use either in the balance sheet or in the income statement. It could be cash, it can be equipment, it could be other fixed assets, it could be any type of liabilities that you may have. It could be your revenues, it's also your expenses, it's also your fund balances. It's everything that you may want to put a bucket of a transaction into, a bucket of money or whatever. Anytime you record a transaction, you're going to have an account.
But it goes so small as things like office supplies. And
it definitely goes into office supplies, rent
salaries.
Expense, salaries. It's anything and everything. Ultimately, you have, and I did not mention this in the slide, but there's what's called a trial balance. A trial balance is a list of everything that is in your balance sheet as well as in your income statement. And so every transaction is going to go into a bucket. It goes back to that initial slide where I showed you about classifying. Well, you're going to classify it into an account. And each one of those accounts, you're going to have a list of those. And that listing is the chart of accounts. The general ledger kind of organizes all your transactions by the accounts that you have, so they give you a total for each one of those. You then have journals and subsidiary journals. So, for instance, you may want to just look at all your cash disbursements. So what you do is you create a journal that shows all of your cash disbursements, and or so all your cash that's paid and checks that are written that are categorized by each one of those charts of, items that are in the chart of accounts. You also have a cash receipts journal that says, okay, here's all the donations that I've received. You may have a list of who the donors are, how much you've received by those donations. What you may even decide to have a sub-classification where you say, okay, what kind of donor was this? Was this a governmental donor, or was this an individual, or was this a corporation? It helps you, again, as a management tool. So you basically say, okay, if most of my donations are coming from legal corporations, then you would know that you may want to focus on attracting more legal donations from that community. So it's not just used for good accounting. It is good use for good management. I can't stress that enough. Part of my background and part of my years of experience, I was 12 years, I was CEO of a corporation. And I've always learned that good accounting systems create excellent management tools. And you need to kind of understand that that's the whole purpose of why we're trying to create good accounting systems. The general journal is when you have a non-cash transaction and you need to record it. Well, you're not using your cash disbursements, you're not using your cash receipts, you're not using your bank account. So you've got to make those, you got to record them somewhere. You record them in a general journal.
Would that be like an in-kind donation? Would something like that go there?
Yes, it would. And so if you're trying to move an in-kind donation, you would also do that in a general journal. You may also have a payroll journal, which keeps up with all your employees, how much they've been paid, how much, you know, taxes you've withheld for each one of those types of items that you're going to want to use to do your 941s or your 940s. Again, if you do have a large payroll staff, there are a lot of companies out there, and I would recommend this highly. They're called PEOs, professional employer organizations, that will do a lot of the payroll items for you. They charge a fee, no doubt. But one of the things I did in starting several small businesses was go to a professional employer organization who basically handles all your accounting as well as all your tax problems for the IRS, and they'll also provide benefits if you're interested in them. And there's a lot of them that are out there, and you can kind of pick and choose, but go online and look up professional employers organization. That'll help you out a lot. And then your check reconciliation, your bank reconciliation. It should be performed every month. Do not fail in doing that bank reconciliation. If you get behind, you'll get behind the next month, you'll get behind the next month. The next thing you know, it'll be at the end of the year, somebody's going to come knocking at your door and basically say, you know, give me an account for where you've spent my money. And you've got to give that accounting. And if you don't have that bank reconciliation done, you're not going to be able to have good balance sheets. You're not going to be able to have any good reports to be able to provide to them. And you really don't want to get put in that position. If you do, the next slide is going to be apropos for you. Financial planning requires long-term thinking, especially if you get caught. At the end of the day, what are we trying to accomplish here? We're trying to accomplish good financial accountability so that people will have trust in you. You're a private nonprofit organization. Already people are not even trusting the for-profit organizations because they've seen the Enrons and they've seen the MCIs and they've seen all of these problems with Madoff, and they are very concerned about how the money is being spent. So when they're doing philanthropy and they're wanting to give out of their own money, they want to make sure it's being put to good use. And so the real purpose here is good financial accountability. To have good financial accountability, one of the things that people would want to look at is, what does your budget look like? How much money are you going to spend this year, and what are you going to spend it on? I kind of want to know, because I'm getting ready to give you a donation, and I want to make sure that you're going to spend my money in a way that I think is beneficial to the community and to the society, and is what I'm willing to invest my money in. So a budget depicts what you expect to earn and expect to spend over a period of time. You may do a quarterly budget, you may do a monthly budget, you may do a yearly budget. My recommendation is to sit down and do a month-to-month budget for an entire year and keep up with it. Because what you'll find out is if you do an entire year and you just say, okay, here's my revenue and here's my expenses and here's how much money I expect to have in this year period of time, well, you may have seasonality in your donations. You may have major expenses that occur one time in a certain month. And so you can look at it for an entire year and you can say, well, gee, you know, my budget looks pretty good. Month three comes by, your donations have been down because most of your donations or most of your grants come in September, and now you have this one-time expense that is more than you have in cash. So what am I going to do? Well, I didn't really plan for that. Well, that's what budgets are going to do for you. They're going to plan for the unexpected. So it's really best to do a budget on a month-to-month basis. You should always review the program and the management achievements and the physical performance over the prior year. Look at what you did in your prior year and say, does this make sense? Does it really make sense that, gross receipts have been down 30% for the entire year last year, but I'm going to expect a 50% increase this year, and I really don't have any good justification as to why I think that 50% is going to come in. Now, you may have found out that, a big supporter of yours has got a huge endowment and recently passed away, and as a result, you know, that money is going to be coming in. You know, at that point in time, you may say, okay, it may make sense for me to do that. Even then, my recommendation is to be as conservative as you possibly can. Do not go out and branch out with expectations that are grandiose. What you should do is when the money comes in, then say, hey, I've got the money, now I can spend it. That's kind of like expecting that 20% raise as an employee, and ultimately the company says, well, we're having a bad year, so we're not going to give you any raises this year. You're lucky to have a job. Don't spend the money before you have it. So don't buy that stereo until you actually know that the raise has actually come in. You should estimate your expenses based upon the future year's objectives, where you want to spend your money and how you want to spend that money. A lot of times people don't understand where that money is actually being spent and what's important and what's not important. So, for me, what's important is not, I've always been told in real business, which would you rather have, a big house or a big office? Because in the businesses that I've worked in, we made sure that we were as lean and mean as we possibly could be in our offices, because we'd rather have a nice house and a nice, money that we can spend for our family. So why would I take on that $10,000 a month rent payment for the office when I could equally have a $5,000 rent payment at the office and have $5,000 for my home? A lot of people don't make those types of decisions, and that really doesn't apply to private nonprofits, but it's an example of how you need to look at your expenses. Is it really worth it to invest in certain items, and is it really meaningful to do so?
Well, and actually in today's world with dwindling, when you look at your budget and you compare from last year, if you think your income is going to be down, then that's the time to start planning for and maybe reducing some of your expenses.
Right.
And looking at the areas where you could do that, for instance, rent, and that's a great example. Maybe it's time to move to a smaller space because it might work better and you could sustain your cash flow over the course of the next year.
Right. And I'll tell you, from budgeting purposes, at times, it really makes good sense to rent being a good example. A lot of times when you have rent, the commitment they want you to commit for is 2-3 years. They don't want you to commit for the next few months. Well, let's say I do my budget and I find out that I am really not going to make my rent payments this year unless something happens. Well, I'm not saying this happens to everybody, but sometimes you can go to the landlord and say, hey, listen, take a look at my budget. And I mean, I really think this is where I'm going to be. And you can say, can you help me out here? Because if not, I'm going to have to leave and we're going to have a dispute on the rent issues. And you can use that in a good management tool again. A lot of times, accounting systems are used, including budgets, for management tools. And so that is the reason why you need to have excellent budgets. And so you also need to look at long-term budgets as far as items like, do I really want to commit to 3 years? Maybe I only want to commit to a 6-month budget or a 1-year budget. So and pay a little extra money because I don't know where I'm going to be 6 months or a year from now. So you need to use that as a management tool.
Yeah, I have a question. One viewer says, our board approves our annual budget. How would a month-to-month budget work in that scenario?
A month-to-month budget, I think, basically is, here's what it looks like on a monthly basis, and then here's the end of the year. It gives your board much better information to be able to make that approval and to be able to answer the hard questions that you really kind of need to answer for your business. So it's not that the board would have to change their methodology of saying, okay, we're going to approve it on a month-to-month basis. You still would approve a yearly budget. However, showing them a month-to-month budget may help them in that decision of whether or not they want to do that yearly approval. I hope that answers the question. You should always compare your revenues and expenses to determine if there's going to be a deficit, a surplus, or break even. At the end of the day, you always want to, it's always better to have a little bit of cash extra that you may want to spend than it is to be at a deficit. Yearly deficits are going to cause one thing. It's called bankruptcy. You don't want to get in that position on a long-term basis. You should make adjustments to your budgets as you're going along. If you have a budget and you're doing a month-to-month budget and something big hits and you realize that you're going to now be incurring an additional several thousand dollars a month into the future, into perpetuity even, you need to include those particular items into your budget and modify your budget so you have a better understanding. As I said, be conservative. Consider the timing of your cash flows and expenses. Also, make sure you consider your restricted donations, your categories of expense budgeting. You should be specific. Call up your insurance carrier and say, hey, listen, what are the premiums going to look like this year? I need to know for purposes of my budget. Consider those registration fees that you're going to have or salaries. And we were discussing today, actually, prior to this, about the restaurant business incurring a one-time cost every year of $15,000 in December, and so a lot of companies will go bankrupt in January 1st because they know they're going to have to make that $15,000 or $20,000 licensing commitment. Well, you've got to really consider that in your budget because you know you're going to have that big hit, and you need to include that in your budget. If you don't, certain things are going to happen. That's enough about budgeting. We've kind of talked about the very basics of accounting. We've talked about the very basics of budgeting. Now we're going to talk a little bit about internal control and what internal control is all about. Internal control systems and having them in place are to protect you. A lot of people think, oh, well, gee, it's to make sure that I'm not stealing money or whatever. It is to protect you. It's to keep you above reproach. And that is the one main goal that you really want to have, is to be above reproach in everything that you do relative to your business, even in your life. So if you don't have any respect for compliance, you're going to be like this guy. And you're going to say, don't mess with me. Well, that's what happened with Madoff. He winds up having bad internal controls. He winds up having a crooked auditor. And next thing you know, it eventually will catch up with you one way or another. What is a good internal control system? It's a series of procedures designed to promote and protect sound management practices, both generally and financially. It requires segregation of duties. Now, the goal of segregation of duties is to make sure that you are above reproach. It says in here that no financial transaction is handled by only one person from beginning to end. That's kind of the process to the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is to make sure that assets are not being diverted, that assets are not being lost, that liabilities are being recorded effectively. And so you need to have good internal control systems. The best way to do that is to have good segregation of duties, have people do different things so that someone that's controlling the cash is not documenting that cash. And the person that's documenting that cash isn't necessarily doing the bank reconciliation. And any of those people are not necessarily authorizing the transactions as well. So if you have one person that can authorize a transaction, that can then handle the cash related to that transaction or the asset, and then can also record that transaction and then reconcile or do some type of balancing of that transaction, you've got a very bad internal control system.
Well, you're lacking checks and balances, which is what you need. It's not any different from why we have, you know, the executive branch and we have Congress and then we have the judicial branch. It's the same thing. You want to make sure that you have enough different people involved to make sure that if mistakes happen, that they're caught and corrected, and that there's not one person with all of the responsibility, but that it's shared amongst the group to ensure that the things that need to be happening are happening. It's always good to have a second set of eyes, you'll hear a lot of times, and it's the same is true when you're talking about internal control and segregating your duties for your accounting system.
I guess a good example is, let's just say we're going to go buy a computer. And we want to make a purchase of a computer today. Well, you really need to have, my computer, for example, I'm the guy that's a bookkeeper, and my computer is now broken. For me to haphazardly go out and buy a computer without having anybody to authorize it or approve it, and I'm just the accounting guy in this system, would be a breakdown in internal controls, because we may not be able to afford that at this particular point in time. Or I may want to go out and buy the grandiose $7,000, state-of-the-art, top-of-the-line, when in fact, that's not necessary for my job duty. I need a $700 Dell. So you need to have somebody else doing the authorization in that. Then, as the accountant, document the fact that, okay, I have an authorization, and now I can go out and make this purchase. Well, if I had the authority to just authorize it and then document it, and then I could write the check, well, where is any internal control? Where is any checks and balances that I've now done something that I should be doing? So for everything, you need to have it kind of broken down. Same thing with cash disbursement and cash receipts. Let's just say that I'm the guy that opens all the mail, and I'm the guy that makes the deposits. Well, let's just say cash comes in the door rather than actually having anybody doing a check and balance. Well, I just put the cash in my pocket rather than actually recording it. Next thing you know, 3 months later, one of my investors is talking to one of the board members and say, "Hey, did you get that $10,000 cash deposit? Cash I got." It's a weird example, but $10,000. No, I never saw it. Well, it's a check and balance that basically you need to have in place so that something like that doesn't happen. And it may not be $10,000. It could be $50. It could be $20 from a little old lady. You want to have good checks and balances. And that's really what the goal is by having good segregation of duties. I will tell you up front, internal controls, good internal controls and segregation of duties are great. But if somebody wants to commit fraud, and there's collusion that's involved where you have two people that are handling these things, it'll be very, very difficult for you to actually detect, for anybody to detect. I've worked on that on numerous occasions.
And it's not just the fraud situation. Again, sometimes it's just mistakes happening and just knowing where things are supposed to go and how they're supposed to be accounted for. So that second set of eyes is just as important for that reason as well as for the fraud issue. And unfortunately, when times are tough, there is more fraud that does occur. So you do need to be more careful. I want to go back to that case study that was presented in the first financial management webinar from last month, and it was about Miss Mary Mack. And Mary Mack has worked with the Lovey Dovey nonprofit for 10 years because she has been with the organization for many years. She's been entrusted to handle a variety of finance functions. In this case, her current responsibilities include a lot of the things we've talked about: receiving and handling, opening and reading all the mail, processing all contributions received and accounts payable, processing and preparing employee and volunteer reimbursements, processing, signing, and mailing checks and accounts payable, making the deposits and taking them to the bank, performing the bank reconciliations, and preparing the annual budgets and financial reports. Basically, she's doing all of the things, and it's just her. And her responsibilities has evolved over time, but has nothing's been done to create any kind of document to finance about these finance policies that she's expected to follow. So she's just kind of doing these things. The executive director has not expressed concern over the lack of documentation. She's proven that she can manage her time well. However, she's had unexpected situations arise from time to time, both personal and with work, and it's made it difficult to handle all of her responsibilities on a timely basis. She doesn't have time to prepare the monthly reconciliations, which, as we've been talking about, may be an issue. She's often behind in preparing the quarterly financial statements, and she's not sure she's doing them properly because she lacks training. Well, this is the exact scenario of what you really don't want to have happen, because if you have good internal controls, even if you only have one person running your organization and you're very small, there are ways to make sure that you have more than one eyes and more than one set of hands handling all of these things. So if you turn to the next slide, we've put together a chart that kind of outlines the four different buckets that we've mentioned. You've got your authorization and the various different kinds of authorization areas, your asset custody, your documentation, and your control duties. And ideally, it'd be great to have four different people, one handling each one of these things. But in a small organization, you might not be able to do that. So what we've outlined below is a way to have maybe your bookkeeper, who may also be your executive director, and maybe a board member or other volunteer who could handle the other responsibilities. The key is to have two sets of eyes on various different things so that you have those checks and balances in place.
And a lot of times you can actually have a second, a third item out there that's not necessarily the bookkeeper or a board member, it's actually the bank itself. If you find yourself in a situation where you only have a couple of people, one good thing to do is go to your bank and ask them if they'll do a lockbox for you. Basically, a lockbox is an account that any checks that are going to be made or any donations are going to be made, they'll mail them directly to the bank. And then the bank actually will notify you and say, okay, here's the receipts that we've received this day. And then every day you just see what you've actually received. And having that third set of eyes that you're not even paying for because they actually are part of your bank is an excellent way to control your cash receipts and what's going in the door.
That helps with asset custody, and that's a great idea for smaller organizations. But again, the key is often when it's just you or just you and your board, it's very difficult to get these kinds of things under control, and you think, well, how else can I do it? But there are easy ways, and if you look at that chart and break it down by those different pieces, I think you'll easily find a way to make that happen. Developing an internal control system, particularly for small nonprofits, there's some key guidelines that you should follow, and they're listed on slide 22. You want to make sure that you have policies, that you actually write down what your chart is and how you're going to make it happen. It takes just a little bit of time, but once it's written down, then if someone leaves the organization, if you do have someone helping you, if a board member retires and you get a new one that's helping you, you have it written down and you know what the plan is and how it's going to work. It doesn't have to be the most eloquent document in the world, but it just needs to be written down, even in bullet point format. So you want to make sure they're clearly written down and are understood and followed. And another key thing is that they're followed from the top, so that if you do have a bigger organization, you want to make sure that the leader of the organization is walking the walk and talking the talk and doing what the policies are. You want to clearly define who's responsible for what, not by the person's name, but by their job responsibility. Maybe it's the treasurer of the board that helps with certain things, or maybe it's the person who comes in once a week, who's your key volunteer that you always have, and you know that even if this particular person isn't that key volunteer, you'll recruit someone else for that role and give it a title so that you know who does what. Have strong physical controls as well. So lock up your assets, make sure your computers are password protected. Put checks in a locked drawer, don't just leave them out. So those are some of the simple physical things to be thinking about. Monitor your cash. Again, that goes back to that chart where you want to have two people who are counting cash, for instance, at a fundraiser. After a fundraising event, make sure you've got two people checking the money and counting it and signing off that they've both come up with the same amount. And then make sure that the two people bring it to the bank together to ensure that it gets to the bank and is safely put where it needs to be and that deposit is occurring. Also you want to make sure that the people that are making the deposit aren't necessarily handling all the other buckets, that they're not making the entry into the books of the amount particularly if it's a single person. So then you've got one person doing all that. Oh yeah, I counted the money and this is how much it was and this is how much I'm putting down in the books. It goes back to his example of just putting a little bit of that in your pocket. And then finally, you also want to make sure that you're reconciling your bank accounts monthly. It's one of those daunting tasks that you always put at the bottom of your list because you really don't want to get to it. But it's one of the most important things. And again, it goes back to the whole idea of what Michael was talking about earlier, which is that use these things as a tool for managing your business. If you get through that monthly account reconciliation, it will help you in managing your business. And it's an important step in doing that. So those are some of the things. Now I'd like to turn to some of the internal control policies and procedures that you should consider having in place, and we start up that on slide 23. Again, these are the basics. This is just writing down who's doing what and how it's being done. So who has responsibility to open your bank statements and to review your bank statements? Want to make sure the checks have cleared and prepare the reconciliation report, and who is doing all of those things, and how is it being done, and when is it being done? You're not going to give the specific names in your policies, but you want to identify the job descriptions of the people who, or the titles of the various different people, even if they're volunteers, as to who's doing what. Goes back to that flow chart. Take the flow chart and put it down on paper. Even if it means that your flow chart is filled in and that is your policy, but it'd be better to have it in a written policy, but at least you have something written down. Credit cards. Most organizations use credit cards now instead of petty cash or to handle a lot of transactions. So the questions to be answered are, who is the holder of the credit card? Who has access to use the credit card? How is access given? And then what is the payment process for dealing with those credit cards? All of that, and who checks to see that it was done properly. So all those various different things should be thought about and put in some kind of policy. And again, it doesn't have to be a long detailed policy, but simply bullet points as to how you're going to handle those various things. Expenditures. How much can one individual spend? Can Michael go out and buy that $7,000 computer? Does he have a limit on how much he can spend, and who has the right to spend how much? And when maybe does your board need to approve a bigger expenditure, and what are those levels of expenditures that are allowed at what levels? So those are some of the things you need to be thinking about to make sure that you have good controls. At the end of the day, your board needs to be aware of and needs to understand your financial situation and needs to have involvement in these policies and procedures. They need to approve them, they need to understand them, and they need to be involved in setting limits and controls. Accounting controls and checks, we've already talked about. That's that flow chart we've mentioned before. Payroll direct deposit. You cannot require your employees to go through direct deposit. You can encourage it, but in the state of Georgia, you cannot require it. But it is a great way and a great management tool if people are interested and willing to do it, because then you can hire one of these payroll companies who can help and assist with that process. And it does make it a much easier way to manage that system. Again, we've talked about segregation of duties and wire transfers. Wire transfers are an issue that also should be discussed amongst your board. Would you ever want to do a wire transfer? Is that something in your business that makes sense? If you do a lot of work internationally, a wire transfer may be essential, and you should have a policy for how that's set up and who has to approve it and what kinds of policies you need to go along with that. Turning to your accounting and financial policies, which is on slide 24, these are some of your basic accounting policies. What method are you going to use? We talked about cash versus accrual. You should have it in your policy which method you plan to use. How often will you present financial statements to the board? How often will you prepare financial statements? What kind of independent review are you going to have? And that will depend in part on how big your organization is and what your board requires, and if you get any kind of grant money. If you're receiving state and federal grant money, often you have to have an audit done. But if you're a smaller organization and you don't rely on those sorts of grants, you may only need a review or a compilation. And in the last webinar on financial policies and procedures, Wendy Stewart described those various different aspects and those various different options in more detail. But it should be in your policies as to which one you're going to do and how you're going to do it. What your policy is going to be on that. Budgets, we've spent a lot of time talking about budgeting. Put down on your in your policy and procedure just what it is that you're going to do. When are you going to prepare a budget? How are you going to prepare it? Who's going to be involved in preparing it? And then when is it going to be presented to your board? Are you going to do a six-month review of your budget based on changes that have occurred and have that as part of your procedures to present that to your board on a six-month basis? So, because they may need to approve changes. Your circumstances may have changed. You can also include in there whether you're going to have your budget prepared sort of in that monthly fashion or just the annual fashion or both. But it's a good idea to just have it written down as to what the expectations are for the organization. Investment policy. This is an important one for any organization that has endowment funds or any kind of additional funds that are set aside that may not be used on a day-to-day basis or needed on a day-to-day basis. What investment risk tolerance do you have? You know, you don't want to be investing in junk bonds, certainly. But, you know, are you only going to do a money market account, or are you going to do other investments, and how are those going to be decided upon? Who's going to be involved? A lot of times nonprofits have an investment committee on their board who will discuss these things and make recommendations to the full board as to what they think you should do with any extra money that you have. In these difficult times where a money market isn't going to bring you in any additional revenue, you may want to look at other options and see what is available. But again, you have to be conservative and understand your risk tolerance, because you've been entrusted with public monies as a charitable organization, and so you want to ensure that you're not putting those monies in the hands of someone like a Madoff, which some charities did do, and so you want to make sure you're protecting
those blackjack table at the Blasio in Vegas is not a sound investment strategy.
That's right. And then you also, in that investment policy, need to consider your restricted funds and what you can and can't do with those in terms of your investment policy. Contributions. Again, you want to make sure there are rules about acknowledging contributions. Those are very clear. Most of you know what those are. You have to give a contemporaneous receipt. You have to make sure that it's within a certain period of time, and you have to put down certain information in your acknowledgement. It's a good idea to have a policy that says that you're going to do that. You know, it's an even better policy to not do it just once a year, but have on a, you know, that maybe within a week of receiving a contribution, that contribution acknowledgement goes out because you're very excited that you've received that contribution in these times. So whatever, but you don't want to give it, create a policy that you can't possibly meet either. So it may be that you do it monthly or within a month. So you want to set your policies and procedures so that you can meet those policies and procedures and follow them. One of the worst things you can do is create policies and procedures and then not follow them. Turning now to slide 25, your accounting and financial policies and procedures. Some other ones to consider are expense reimbursement. Do you allow for travel? What are the policies around travel? What are the rules? What's allowed? What has to be pre-approved? And what is the approval process? All that should be written down in your policies and procedures. Reimbursement for meals. It should also be another similar type of policy that you should address. Petty cash. A lot of organizations no longer have petty cash because they have that credit card option. So if you don't have, do you allow for petty cash? Is it something that you would need? And what are the processes and policies and procedures around that? Loans to employees. Highly suggest you do not allow loans to employees. You're not in the business of loaning money, and it's something the IRS really looks very carefully at and has over the last 10 years or so. So it's not encouraged that you ever give loans to employees. You should have a policy to that effect. Again, check preparation and mailing. That goes back to that flowchart we talked about earlier on. Sales tax collection. If you need to collect sales tax on some of the activities that you're conducting, you need to have a policy and procedure in place for how that's going to be done, and that you're going to remit that money, because the worst thing you can do is collect sales tax and not remit it, and how you're going to comply with any state requirements for sales tax compliance. IRS Form 1099s. If you have any independent contractors, you want to make sure that you get them that 1099 after they've done the work for you. and you've paid them. So you want to ensure that you have proper compliance with that, because it's something the IRS and the Georgia Department of Labor is looking at much more closely. You want to have, finally, you want to have another policy on submitting your Form 990. Now every nonprofit is required to submit a Form 990, even if it's just a 990N postcard. So make sure you have it in your policies and procedures, and it's just something else that you check off, that you get it done and get it submitted, and what the process is for doing that. That's something your board should be reviewing as well. With that, we've come to our last slide, which has some general information on how to reach us. Are there any questions?
There are a couple. The first one is, our board does not know how to read or interpret balance sheets. What reports do you recommend we give them?
I think what you need to do is, first, and with any board that you have, you need to have somebody that's got some decent accounting skills. I mean, if your board consists of people that are not financially savvy, I think you still need to give them the reports, and you actually need to give them a basic understanding. If it means watching this video today, this webinar today, you're going to need to sit down and you're going to need to educate them. Because at the end of the day, what is the purpose of your board members? It's the purpose of your board is to make sure that you're meeting the goals of the organization that you have, and to understand basic accounting would be part of those goals that you're going to have, because it ultimately is going to drive what your management is going to be and how your board decisions are going to be made. So I think you still need to give them the balance sheet. You need to give them an income statement. And if they don't understand it, you're going to need to educate them a little bit as to what you need to be doing. And that may be having a tax preparer or, you know, another accountant come in and kind of give them a basic tutorial as well as to what they in fact are looking at.
Yeah, and that's actually a good idea. You may just contact your accountant and say, would you mind coming to one of our board meetings and just kind of laying this out for our board members if you don't feel confident doing that with your board members.
One other viewer says, I see the danger of employee loans. How about occasional pay advances when the organization only pays salaries once monthly?
You need to stick with whatever your payment is for your salaries. If your salary is only paid monthly, there should be no pay advances. Either you pay bi-monthly or you pay monthly, and you can't veer from that, and you shouldn't veer from that. When you start to, one, it's going to mess with your payment to your employees for salary. You have to take out all of your withholdings, and if you start giving advances, then it's going to start mess with your accounting system for your employee withholdings. So I highly suggest that you do not do any advances. If your employees cannot manage their own financial situations, then you have to look at what they're doing for your organization and make sure that they should be there and that they're doing the things that they should be doing. I know people have difficult times and things come up, but the other option is that you don't pay them monthly, you pay them bi-monthly.
One viewer says, FYI, Georgia law requires that you pay employees twice a month.
I'm not an attorney.
I'm not an employment attorney, and if that issue does come up, we could certainly have an employment attorney look into that.
Those are all the questions.
Thank you.